Blog Talk Radio.
Aaron McCready.
News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens. A statement today from the family of a U.S. aid worker recently killed by Islamic militants.
The parents of aid worker and former Army Ranger Peter Kasich, composed yet filled with sorrow, read from a prepared statement.
Our hearts are battered, but they will mend. The world is broken, but it will be healed in the end.
Kasich, a Muslim convert who also went by the name Abdul Rahman, was kidnapped October 2013 in eastern Syria.
Fox's Catherine Herridge. Republicans in Congress still trying to figure out how to respond to President Obama's expected unilateral action on immigration reform. They could go after some federal funding.
They want to come up strongly and argue against what the president may propose on immigration reform, but they don't want to play with fire. And playing with fire is messing with that spending bill, which could result in a government shutdown. That's what happened in the fall of last year, where the government shut down over Obamacare.
Fox Radio's Chad Pergram on Capitol Hill. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon declaring a state of emergency, activating the National Guard there. This ahead of an expected grand jury decision on possibly charging a white police officer in the fatal shooting of a black unarmed 18-year-old in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. Nixon also outlining some police protocol.
Under the executive order, the St. Louis County Police Department will have command and operational control over security in the city of Ferguson in areas of protests and acts of civil disobedience should such activities occur instead of the Ferguson Police Department in that jurisdiction.
No indication yet, though, on the timing of any possible announcement. Honda quietly offering to replace potentially defective airbag inflators across the U.S., even though its latest recall for the problem only covers cars in 13 high humidity states and territories. Honda, though, does not plan to notify customers outside the recall areas. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs. I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Federal agents descending on some NFL teams on Sunday looking for drug violations.
Among the teams targeted, the San Francisco 49ers, with DEA agents searching bags and questioning doctors after the 49ers game at the New York Giants. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were also met by agents as they prepared to head home after their game against Washington. Bucs officials tweeting, quote, "Authorities checked in with our travel party at BWI, and after a five-minute delay, we proceeded onto our plane without incident." The inspection stemmed from a class action lawsuit filed by former NFL players, including Jim McMahon and Richard Dent. The suit claims team officials doled out painkillers simply to get players back on the field.
Fox's Jonathan Hunt in New York. A man who drove around a Des Moines, Iowa suburb today, randomly opening fire, now charged with attempted murder. Officials in Pleasant Hill saying 32-year-old Pete Jason Polson, has been linked to three shootings within a 12-minute span. Two men hit and have been hospitalized, a third fired at, but was not hurt. The House approved it. Now it's on to the Senate for a vote on the Keystone XL oil pipeline.
Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker sounds cautiously optimistic.
If Harry Reid lets the members of the Democratic caucus vote the way they want to, it will pass.
If it gets through, Democrats like Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse say President Obama should veto.
I think it's important to send that signal right off the bat. I think the new Republican majority has long despised and denigrated this president. And if they can roll him, I think they would like to. And I think it's important that he sets the stage early on this, particularly where the stakes are so high.
In Washington, Mike Emanuel, Fox News Radio.
A Virginia woman, Heather Elizabeth Kaufman, facing a federal charge for allegedly promoting the Islamic State group on social media. I'm Paul Stevens, Fox News Radio.
You have read about him in the Huffington Post. You have seen him quoted in Esquire magazine. The Washington Post writes about him, and you saw him on MSNBC. This is Aaron McCready. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready or visit him on the web at AaronMcCready.com.
Welcome to the broadcast, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. It is great to have you with us today. Boy, let me tell you about some of the troubles we have had up until just 5 seconds before we aired. All last week, we've had IT troubles and could not get the show up and running live. So it's always been previous episodes playing. It's always been, the best of, I guess. And everything was fine and dandy. And then up until about 5 seconds, literally before the show started, we finally got up on the air. Everything was crashing. It was driving me nuts. I mean, it was, as you can imagine, it was just pure chaos. So literally 5 seconds before the show went on air, everything came back up and running. And we have got finally a show for you today, a live show. And it's my honor and privilege to have two people on today. Later on, coming up in the bottom half of the show, we're going to have Jack Caravelli on. Jack worked for the CIA for over 20 years, and then he also went from the CIA over to the White House and worked for President Bill Clinton. He was in charge of the Russia's nuclear nonproliferation policy. And designing a plan in case we did go to war with Russia, a nuclear war, what that would entail. After Bill Clinton, he was held over with the George W. Bush administration, and he worked in the Energy Department there. So he's going to come on. He's going to talk to us about some of the things ISIS, Iraq. We're not hearing a lot from Russia right now. So he's going to tell us all about those and give us a little bit of foreign intelligence straight from someone that worked in the White House and the CIA. But on the newsmaker line right now, I am very pleased to have Janine Stang. She's been on the show before. She's a good friend of the show. You have seen her on Fox News. You've seen her on CNN. You've seen her on ABC, NBC, CBS. You name it, she's been on there. She's the only person in history to sing the national anthem in all 50 states, and this year she accomplished it in the state of Tennessee, and I am partial to Tennessee. I lived there for a few years, originally from Virginia, as you guys know, but really Tennessee is my stomping ground. But I am pleased to welcome on the line Janine Stang. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Aaron. Good to be here. Glad to hear your technology issues are resolved.
Oh, it's been a nightmare. I mean, literally 5 seconds, I thought we're going to have to start sending messages out saying it's been canceled again because it's just been crazy. But, you know, it drives you nuts when things don't work like that.
Yeah, it's supposed to work. And well, I told you I had the same, it must be something with technology. Thankfully, I just, mine are resolved as well, but I was without a computer for 2 weeks.
Well, you know, with what you do and go around the country, I mean, that's vital for you. I mean, you really need a computer.
I was working from an iPhone for a while. Oh, my goodness. You never realize how small the screen is until you're staring at it basically 24/7.
Well, hey, you need the iPhone Plus. You know, it's the size of an iPad pretty much.
Yeah, I heard it bends. I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, hey, tell us what's been going on. You sang, you haven't been on the show since you hit State 50 in Tennessee. Tell us a little bit about that. It looked like you were having a great time, but it was a little wet.
Yes, it was. It was raining. It was in the middle of, well, it was towards the end of the summer. I did not think there was going to be any rain. There wasn't a cloud in the sky when I got there to do the sound check. And I was telling everybody, every reporter, it never rains when I sing. Don't worry about it. Well, it did on State 50. But it actually made for good photos. The rain and the rain as it came down, it kind of looked like sparkles. You know, as a girl, it's always nice to have something like that. So the photos are pretty cool. And one of the players, Sean Phillips, I think his name is, he actually gave me a towel at the end. So at least I sort of was able to dry off.
Now, looking back, would you have changed that day at all? Would you
no.
have changed the rain? And yeah.
Absolutely not. I just think that it added to the, you know, some of the photos of the Titans actually just sent me a couple of, about a week or so ago. It just looks like something you couldn't even create on a movie set. And I just think it added to how important that day was for me, you know, and for a lot of the very faithful followers I have on Facebook and Twitter. It just was a very cool thing. So I wouldn't change anything about it. Except maybe so the Titans would have won. I don't think they won. So
yeah, no, they didn't do too well. But
no.
And then you were on XM Radio, and you know, that day, and actually the day before.
Yeah.
That was pretty awesome on the highway.
It was very cool to meet Stormy Warren. He was very fun, and I got to sing on the air. We talked for a while, actually, and he was very excited about what had just happened, and you know, again, just to be on that show was pretty cool.
Well, tell us too. We've got a lot of new listeners out there. Really, why you started this? I mean, it's, you know,
sure.
It's not something that somebody you know, just says, hey, I'm going to sing in all 50 states, and then maybe they go to states 1 through 5.
It's not
and then...
for the easily discouraged.
Well, remind everybody why you started this for.
Sure. I started out in July, on July 3rd, 2012, to sing the national anthem in all 50 states. At the point of singing on July 3rd, I probably had about 6 states under my belt. And I really saw a need because I sung the national anthem a lot, I mean hundreds of times before I decided to start this quest. And I did see that there was a lot of people out there that, of course, respect the anthem and sing it with everything they have, but there's also a lot of people, very much so the upcoming generations, that may not have necessarily known why they were standing, why the hand was on their heart, they didn't know the words. You know, you can see it from the vantage point that I was always at. And I really felt that instead of waiting for other people to do something about it or some program to launch, I said, well, if I go around, sort of how somebody goes and runs a marathon for a specific cause. If I sing the anthem in all 50 states, it'll give me a platform to talk about how important the national anthem is, and really the fact that it embodies the brave men and women embody the meaning of that song. If we didn't have people out there right now keeping us safe and free, and those that have gone before doing the same thing, the national anthem, the words wouldn't mean a thing. So.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, and then two, each time you sing the national anthem, one thing that I really appreciate and like is that you have thank you cards that someone can
yes.
just come up and write thank you cards and send it
mm-hmm.
to a member of the military to thank them for everything
That's
that
right.
they've done.
Yes, at each event and all the venues were very gracious to allow me to have tables where I would have people come up, sign cards. They would, in their own words, express their gratitude, which at first sometimes people are like, oh my goodness, I have to think of something myself. I don't just have to sign my name and write the state that I'm from. And by the end of that experience, which I call it an experience because it really touched each of these people, leaving the table, you saw they were different. Their face looked different. They actually were able to say something to somebody who was out there putting their life on the line for them. And I think that was so important because I think it links our gratitude to the national anthem and to those who embody the meaning, like I said before. And I'm actually still doing that with the thank you cards. I started a, I don't know if you, yes, you have seen it, Aaron, because you very nice to tweet it. Started something called Thanks from All 50. One day I was looking at a box of, you know, the thank you cards that I was giving to Operation Gratitude, and I said, boy, I'd love to keep doing this. So I said, you know what, I'll send out a pack of 10 thank you cards to every person that sends me an email with their mailing address, and I've been doing that. We've got 49 states represented so far. We need New Mexico.
New Mexico. Come on, everyone in New Mexico.
New Mexico is, I don't know.
What?
There's
what's
out
going
there?
On with New Mexico? We need to get some people out there. Come on.
Yeah, so if you look up the hashtag, thanks from all 50, you'll see a photo with the address, which is admin@nationalanthemgirl. Send me your mailing address, not your email address, your mailing address, so we can physically send you a bunch of cards that you will fill out and send back, and we'll get them into Operation Gratitude Care packages.
You know, throughout your travels in all 50 states, which memory sticks out with you the most? You know, because, I mean, you've got to, you know, I mean, not just necessarily singing the national anthem, you know, in front of the Tennessee Titans or in front of major league ballparks, but, you know, when you see the people that are coming up to the table to fill out the thank you cards to send to our men and women in military, what really stands out in your experiences, you know, because you are making a difference to thousands of people, and you know, being in the military is a thankless job. So, you know, I guess what sticks out to you when people fill out the cards?
There are so many moments. I mean, I think I've shared a couple of them where I was in Montana and a gentleman came up to the table and he told me how he regretted every day that he didn't serve because he had a lot of buddies who had gone away and never came back. And he felt as if, you know, maybe if he would have been there, he might have been able to help them. Then you meet I met Cliff. His name is Cliff, 92-year-old World War II veteran, stormed the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. I got to sit and talk with him. He was in Kentucky. He was adorable. He told me if the country needed him to fight, he would just say, where are my bags? I'm going. And he said he could still shoot the big guns. But he brought me to tears just because he was so genuine. And I even said to him, what's your advice to upcoming generations? And he said, this is your land. Love it, live in it, and protect it. And it's not something that he just thought up and said, this will be a nice little catchy thing. This was really him saying, this is what I would advise you to do. And, you know, they don't call them the greatest generation for nothing. Since I sang in all 50 states, I've gotten to sing for an honor flight, Texas Permian Basin. And, oh, my goodness, I mean, that was amazing. I got to sing at almost every war memorial with a ton of Vietnam, Korean War, and World War II veterans as the audience. So it doesn't get any better than that. And we also went to Arlington Cemetery where I sang for two Gold Star services, and the tears were shooting out of my eyes. It wasn't even something I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to sing. That's how moved I was. You know, you see these stones in Section 60. I'm sure you're familiar with that section.
Right.
They are born, you know, in the 80s or, you know, and then their date of death is like 2011, 2012, 2013. You're like, geez, their lives were so short. And that really hits you hard. I think everybody should go and see Section 60. I think everybody should go look at these war memorials because it'll make you realize freedom is not free. Like the Korean War memorial has that, and it's amazing.
Well, you know, too many people now just take it for granted. They go among their lives, and you know, they're able to go to the, you know, to the grocery store, go out shopping, go hang with friends, whatever it may be, but if it wasn't for those men and women, that, and especially the ones that paid the ultimate sacrifice like you're talking about, I mean, we would not be able to do that. And it just, you take a step back when you really think about it.
And you know, I say too, I've said this a bunch of times on your show as well, gratitude is the core of patriotism. And, you know, when I talked to Cliff, you know, talk about him for another second, he told me these weren't just like, oh, yeah, it was really fun, we got back. They were throwing up after they had done what they did. And then he said some of them went and committed suicide. They couldn't handle it. They were talking about PTSD. You know, there's so many things that they dealt with. And still, our men and women are still dealing with this. And it's, you really sit there and you say, this really is happening. It's not something that you could put on television, watch it, turn it off, and say, oh, it's too much for me. These people lived it. And I think that's an important dialogue for all the parents out there to have with their kids. You know, freedom isn't free. We're here in this country. You can think of something you want to do, whether it's kid on the moon, whether it's, you know, invent something, you can do it because you're in America and you're free to do that. We don't realize that all the time.
You know, and that's why people all over the world come to America, because we truly are. You know, we may have our problems, we may have our squabbles, and you know politics and those political games. But people around the world really want to come to America for a better life, and to raise families and to help their families and to give their children things that they would not have been able to have in their country. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes America great.
Yeah, and it's the people. It's the decision that every day that we make. I don't address politics in my social media. It's a platform to be able to respect those people who represent this country. And I always say, you know, if we're so involved, I understand we all have our opinions. We're free to have that. But at the same time, just take a minute to realize that you have those opinions because there are people fighting no matter what side you are voting for. Respect those lives. They're human beings who have families who are not going to be home for Thanksgiving coming up, different things like that. Just do something good and you'll see a change. And the change will start in your own little world, on your block, in your company, in your, you know, school, whatever.
Right. Well, how was State 49? That was Hawaii, right?
State 49 was 48 was Hawaii, 49 I'm getting that confused. No, 49 was Hawaii. I'm sorry.
Don't make me start drilling you. What's state 13?
Somebody's going to tell me. Somebody's going to tell me 25. I'm wrong. I need to look this up. I don't know. Aaron, I need my Excel spreadsheet.
Well, if your computer wouldn't have crashed, maybe
Hawaii
you'd have it.
Hawaii was awesome. Hawaii, yes. I'm just going to blame the computer. Hawaii was awesome. I sang aboard the USS Missouri. So to have all these humongous ships in the background while I sang, singing on one of them, one very historic ship, which is where the Instrument of Peace was signed with Japan for World War II, was pretty impressive. And even most recently, I was in D.C., and Sirius XM 60s on 6 Flash Phelps took me to go and see the birthplace as well as the burial ground for Francis Scott Key. So what was really interesting about that was that it was literally the last place I sang that was significant. Somebody else said that I could actually go and find the place where he was killed, but where he died. The last spot I sang of significance in that whole Francis Scott Key thing was where he was born. So it kind of a little bit like, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, kind of went to the back, backwards. But getting to go to the burial ground was very interesting. I met the groundskeeper and his wife, and the director of tourism from Frederick, Maryland came and gave me a key to the city of Frederick, which was very cool. I got to sing it right there. And so I sang it where Francis Scott Key is right while his body is there right now. So it was pretty cool.
Did you imagine when you started all this how far it would have taken you and that, you know, 50 states later?
No.
You know, it would have changed you as a person?
I had no idea how I was going to do it. You know, a lot of times people think that I've gotten paid to do this, that I get, you know, some kind of, I don't know, some imaginary sponsor, but I did have some generous donations from a crowdfunding campaign that I did. But other than that, just saying I wanted to do it was the way I started. And then I just plodded through. So, no, I didn't know that. I didn't know how it was going to look. I didn't know. I mean, I was determined to finish, but I didn't know how, when, where, none of that, no.
Well, you know, that says a lot about, you know, your determination, American determination. Is you set a goal, you go for it, you stay laser-focused, and you accomplished it. So, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of people that you met and people that you didn't meet, you really touched their lives. And I know all the members of the military owe you a debt of gratitude.
Oh, geez, well, I owe it to them. They're always the most humble individuals when I meet them. I met a guy, I was just about to sing, and everybody was clapping for him because somebody announced that he had, was the recipient of a Purple Heart, and he wasn't looking for any kind of applause. He was just happy, and, you know, when I talked to him afterwards, he said he'd do it all over again. And that's every time you speak to somebody who is in the military, that's pretty much what they're saying in their response, and I just think that's incredible, really.
Well, you know, Well, you know, even when I'm out in public and I see someone that has, you know, even, you know, you have, see a senior citizen that has a hat on from, you know, the ship that they served in, or even a member of the military that's in uniform, I always go up to them, shake their hand, and say thank you for everything you've done. And mm-hmm. most recently, I was at a gas station, and it was off the main interstate, and there was a huge convoy of all these Hummers, and it looked like that the military was invading this gas station. And I went inside, and I probably spent 20 minutes just shaking hands. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you know, I mean, especially the people that especially the senior citizens, when they're wearing those hats, you go up to them and say that. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, it really brings tears to their eyes, because you know they mm-hmm. had a thankless job, and no one really ever thanked them.
Yeah, and they deserve it. You know, they really do. And I remember when I was I sang for it was a memorial at the Air Force Memorial, and to watch the families who had lost somebody who wasn't that old, you know, it wasn't like they died of a ripe old age. They were missing sons and daughters. Just to see that, you know, makes you even say all the more to honor the lives while they're here, because
right.
they have to know they're appreciated. It's something that they're doing for not just themselves, they're selfless. And that's important as a lesson. It's important to learn. It's important to get over that little, oh gosh, I don't know what to say in a thank you card, or I don't know, they might look at me crazy if I go up and shake their hand. You know, I was told one time there was somebody that they were going to commit suicide, but because somebody walked over and smiled at them, just because of a smile, they changed
wow.
their course of action. So if you think about that, you know, PTSD, this is a statistic, it's terrible, 22 veterans commit suicide a day because of PTSD. It's horrible, horrible. And if we can make a difference in their life, you know, some people say, oh, I don't know, maybe a thank you card's not going to mean anything. What if it does? What if it saves
right.
somebody's life?
Right. Just like the smile. You know, who would have thought just a single smile, you know, would have saved
yeah.
that person's life?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, we just had a few more minutes.
It, Aaron.
Well, we just have a few more minutes, and the show would not be complete unless I give you a hard time about taunting me with flying and aviation. And everyone out there knows that I have my pilot's license. I love to fly. And we've talked about this on shows before. And for everyone out there, you haven't been on since you did this, but you let me know one time that you were going to be flying on a Learjet. And
yeah.
And I asked you to take pictures, and you took pictures, and you sent me videos. And I was sitting there watching it just green with envy. So I really appreciate you taunting me.
I wasn't going to bring this up, Aaron. Wasn't going to say anything.
Well, you know, and I told you this too before, that Learjet makes my little single-engine planes, you know, just look like little Pintos flying around out there. It's just,
I know.
I appreciate
horrible.
It.
Horrible.
Well, next time you're in Georgia, we're going to have
to
go up.
Okay. Well, I told all the pilots that I was with that I have a friend who would be very upset about it, and they agreed.
Well, thanks. That makes me feel even better now. I really appreciate that.
I know. I'll put you in touch with them. Actually, I want one of them to talk on your show because they do the honor flight, the veteran airlift, which is very an amazing thing that they do. So you'll get to talk to them yourself. All right.
Good. And for those of you that don't know what the Veterans Airlift is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they fly families to meet the members of the military that serve that are injured or hurt, whatever, and to be with them in the hospital while they get care. Is that correct?
Yeah. There are certain medical procedures that if they're in a specific location that doesn't have a hospital that can treat them the best way they can, some of them find themselves they're stranded. So these heroes go pick them up in their jets and take them to the best place for them to get care. It's a really amazing thing that they do.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. You're welcome back anytime. Thanks for being a good friend of the show. Continued luck to you as you, you know, go across the nation and, you know, thanking our military veterans. And again, I think the nation owes you a debt of gratitude for what you've done, because no one's ever done it before, singing the national anthem in all 50 states. So on behalf of a grateful nation, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's an honor. And people can follow me on Facebook or Twitter. They can just go to nationalanthemgirl.org
then you could click the Facebook or the Twitter icon and follow me. I do posts all the time and would love to have you on my social media.
Well, there you have it, the National Anthem Girl, Janine Stang. Thank you for coming on. Again, you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks, Aaron. Have a good day. Night.
You too. Thanks.
Bye.
Well, as you heard it, you know, she's someone that didn't do this for money. She actually financed most of this herself, singing the national anthem in all 50 states, just to show gratitude for our men and women in military. We're going to take a news break. We're going to be right back with foreign intelligence from a veteran of the CIA and a member of Bill Clinton's White House and George W. Bush's White House, Jack Caravelli. We'll be right back.
Aaron McCready.
News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens. A statement today from the family of a U.S. aid worker recently killed by Islamic militants.
The parents of aid worker and former Army Ranger Peter Kasich, composed yet filled with sorrow, read from a prepared statement.
Our hearts are battered, but they will mend. The world is broken, but it will be healed in the end.
Kasich, a Muslim convert who also went by the name Abdul Rahman, was kidnapped October 2013 in eastern Syria.
Fox's Catherine Herridge. Republicans in Congress still trying to figure out how to respond to President Obama's expected unilateral action on immigration reform. They could go after some federal funding.
They want to come up strongly and argue against what the president may propose on immigration reform, but they don't want to play with fire. And playing with fire is messing with that spending bill, which could result in a government shutdown. That's what happened in the fall of last year with a government shutdown over Obamacare.
Fox Radio's Chad Pergram on Capitol Hill. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon declaring a state of emergency, activating the National Guard there. This ahead of an expected grand jury decision on possibly charging a white police officer in the fatal shooting of a black unarmed 18-year-old in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. Nixon also outlining some police protocol.
Under the executive order, the St. Louis County Police Department will have command and operational control over security in the city of Ferguson in areas of protests and acts of civil disobedience should such activities occur instead of the Ferguson Police Department in that jurisdiction.
No indication yet, though, on the timing of any possible announcement. Honda quietly offering to replace potentially defective airbag inflators across the U.S., even though its latest recall for the problem only covers cars in 13 high humidity states and territories. Honda, though, does not plan to notify customers outside the recall areas. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs. I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Federal agents descending on some NFL teams on Sunday looking for drug violations.
Among the teams targeted, the San Francisco 49ers, with DEA agents searching bags and questioning doctors after the 49ers game at the New York Giants. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were also met by agents as they prepared to head home after their game against Washington. Bucs officials tweeting, quote, "Authorities checked in with our travel party at BWI, and after a five-minute delay, we proceeded onto our plane without incident." The inspection stemmed from a class action lawsuit filed by former NFL players, including Jim McMahon and Richard Dent. The suit claims team officials doled out painkillers simply to get players back on the field.
Fox's Jonathan Hunt in New York.
A man who drove around a Des Moines, Iowa suburb today, randomly opening fire, now charged with attempted murder. Officials in Pleasant Hill saying 32-year-old Pete Jason, Polson, has been linked to three shootings within a 12-minute span. Two men hit and have been hospitalized, a third fired at but was not hurt. The House approved it. Now it's on to the Senate for a vote on the Keystone XL oil pipeline.
Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker sounds cautiously optimistic.
If Harry Reid lets the members of the Democratic caucus vote the way they want to, it will pass.
If it gets through, Democrats like Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse say President Obama should veto.
I think it's important to send that signal right off the bat. I think the new Republican majority has long despised and denigrated this president, and if they can roll him, I think they would like to. And I think it's important that he sets the stage early on this, particularly where the stakes are so high.
In Washington, Mike Emanuel, Fox News Radio.
A Virginia woman, Heather Elizabeth Kaufman, facing a federal charge for allegedly promoting the Islamic State group on social media. I'm Paul Stevens, Fox News Radio.
Is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope, bringing the nation back one photo at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. If you're just joining us, you missed the national anthem girl, Jeanine Stang. You saw her on Fox News, CNN, NBC, ABC. The list goes on, but she's the only person that's ever sang the national anthem in all 50 states. So my thanks to her for coming on the show. Coming up here in just a second is a very good friend of the show as well, Jack Caravelli. Jack, as you know, has extensive experience in the CIA and foreign intelligence. He also served under President Bill Clinton and with the Russia's nuclear non-proliferation. And since he's been on last, I've learned to say proliferation. And then he also worked in energy for the George W. Bush administration. He also has a book out, Beyond Sand and Oil, the Nuclear Middle East. Jack Caravelli, welcome to the program.
Aaron, as always, thanks very much, and it's great to be with you.
We've got a lot to talk about today, and as you know, and as our listeners know, ISIS has really struck again. They really strike every day, but another American was beheaded, and, you know, what is it really going to take to stop ISIS? Because these are thugs, these are the worst criminals imaginable. They have, you know, children carrying heads of beheaded, you know, people. I mean, it's just very scary and frightening. What's it going to take for us to stop these thugs?
Well, Aaron, great question. You're absolutely right. First of all, they are thugs, but they're also very clever thugs. They're very focused thugs, and that makes them very dangerous thugs. The beheading you mentioned is just the most recent, as you noted, in really now a series of beheadings that are barbaric, atrocious. I mean, pick a word. Some Americans have been beheaded. A couple of British aid workers. It wasn't noticed very much in the media, but ISIS has also killed dozens, if not hundreds, in the region. Soldiers fighting them, when they capture them, they either behead them or kill them in other ways. So it's a very dangerous organization. What will it take to defeat them? Well, you know, I guess I would start to your very good question by saying it's going to take a lot more than what we're doing now. You know, I was looking earlier, and I think this is right on to your question. I was looking earlier today, actually, knowing I would be on your show, at, you know, the extent of the bombing campaign after September 2001, as you may recall, Aaron, we started heavy bombing in Afghanistan against the Taliban. And in the 65 days that we first carried out those strikes, there were literally thousands of what they call air sorties, individual attacks against Taliban targets. And I went and I compared the first 65 days of what we've been doing in Iraq and now more recently Syria against ISIS. And the level of our air attacks is literally one-tenth of what we did over a decade ago in Afghanistan. Now, you know, I know we can argue that there's different reasons for that. One of them is really our fault that we have no good ground intelligence to, you know, to help us with these strikes, et cetera. But, you know, the fact of the matter is ISIS has been able to capture large swaths of territory, about one-third of Iraq, about one-third of Syria, and that combined total, again, I was trying to do the simple math, is right now ISIS operates or and controls about territory the size of Great Britain. That's really it's shocking, and it's also pretty impressive. And, you know, for us to think that we're going to uproot them, let alone defeat them, with the very modest efforts that we've been putting in to date, you know, I think, frankly, Aaron, we're whistling past the graveyard.
Well, what's going on? You've worked in the White House. What's going on, you know, behind the scenes? Because, I mean, does the president have advisors that are telling him exactly what you're telling me, or are they just, you know, are they just letting him hear what he wants to hear, or is he just that stubborn or that stupid, and I mean President Obama, to not do what it takes, or does he not have the will? I mean, to me, if I was president of the United States, I would go after these thugs with all I had, because eventually they're going to come over here to the United States, or they're going to, like the lone wolf terrorists, they're going to hit the streets, and then, you know, it's going to be all over the world. I mean, what's going on behind the scenes in this White House, and why aren't we doing anything about it?
Well, Aaron, another great question. Let me pick up first on the last point you made and then go to the big question.
Okay.
What we know is that some of the jihadi fighters with ISIS either have American passports or passports in various European countries, perfectly valid, and they've traveled from their home countries to fight with ISIS. They're being trained. They're getting combat experience. And we know for a fact that we've seen this already in some cases in Europe, where returning fighters on these valid passports have gone back home and they've carried out attacks in their home countries. So this is really a very dangerous organization. Now, back to your big question, and it's incredibly important. And I think there are a couple of, I guess, aspects to it. The first is that I certainly hope and expect that my former colleagues at the CIA and other parts of the U.S. intelligence community are bringing to bear to the White House sort of the cold, hard, objective facts, because that's their job. That's their mission, to inform, obviously, the key policy leaders. Now, the second part is what's happening to that information when it gets into the White House. You know, Aaron, as I think you and I have discussed previously, this administration, this president, has been probably the weakest foreign policy president, certainly in my memory, and probably since at least the end of World War II. And that covers a lot of ground. Now, you know, part of it is, you know, this president seems to have no, as I've said in the past, guiding star, you know, to really hold and focus and direct U.S. policy from. Now let's think about this. I think any U.S. president in the past worth his salt, you know, if he had received reports and seen videos of the beheadings of U.S. citizens, there would have been so much outrage on the part of the president that he would have taken the kind of action that you suggested, you know, in your question, that, you know, people cannot behead Americans around the world and think they can do so without being punished and paying a price for it. Well, you know, this president has been extremely reluctant to commit U.S. resources, you know, to support our legitimate our interests, you know, particularly in the Middle East. You know, obviously what we're seeing is the bitter fruit now of ISIS that obviously takes the measure of him, just as Vladimir Putin has done in the Russia-Ukraine situation. They've judged, I think, largely correctly that he is not prepared, for whatever reasons, to engage them heavily. He has not gone to the American public and made the case that this is an outrage, that this threatens U.S. vital interests for the reasons I stated, and that we not only need to commit more proper resources to do this job, and that doesn't mean just sending thousands of U.S. forces. It means sending forces to train others and work with them and make them capable of defending themselves, but also that he would go to the U.S. Congress, because I am very worried, Aaron, about the diminishing capability of our military because of these budget cuts.
Right.
This hits us across the board, and I really hope that if there's any message I can convey to your many listeners, that, you know, they should reach out and say, this is dangerous. We as a nation often do this. We come out of wars and we collect our, you know, we do a sigh of relief and we cut forces, we cut budgets, and we wind up getting in trouble. And I am terribly concerned that this will happen again. We need resources, financial and manpower, you know, to deal with these types of situations around the world. I do not advocate jumping into, you know, every problem or boiling pot of water around the world. But what I do think is, in this situation, given what ISIS has achieved, the in their really long-term plan to establish a caliphate, you know, in a Muslim nation that they would control under Sharia law in that part of the world, you know, we've got to do better. Again, back to your question, we've got to do more, better, faster than what we're doing now.
Well, what is it also as far as, you know, could it, you know, I know Putin and ISIS, they've had to see a reaction to the assassination of your friend, Ambassador Stevens, Chris Stevens.
Yes, indeed.
And there was absolutely no reaction there. It was just appalling that a United States ambassador could be assassinated and no repercussions come to anyone. And they've had to have seen that, other things around the world that we turn a blind eye to. And is it almost like the bully on the playground? The bully knows that he can always get away with it until somebody actually stands up to him and pops him right in the mouth. I mean, is that, you know, when they see that we have a very strong offense, you know, the best defense is a strong offense, or the best, you know, vice versa. And,
you know,
what's it going to take?
Well, Aaron, you know, again, thanks for the question. It's one that I hope that many people are really mulling over, the, you know, the fact of the matter. And I think the point you make is absolutely the right one, that, you know, people, you know, Obama and this White House of weak advisors, that they act as if, you know, when they make a decision, it's almost like that they're not concerned or didn't factor in how the world would view it and how people would react. And the fact of the matter is, now after 6 years of Obama talking about red lines that are crossed with impunity, Ambassador Stevens tragically being lost, as you mentioned, in Libya, you know, people around the world see these things. As I said earlier, they take the measure of this president. They find him really lacking in moral courage. They find his leadership, you know, almost vacuum. And they clearly factor this into the actions that they take. And, you know, America still is, if it chooses, the indispensable power around the world. And we don't, and I would add to the listeners who think, well, we can't do it all, and they're right. But I would say that, again, in key critical areas, we are indispensable in the sense that, you know, there's no other nation or group of nations prepared to make things a little better, a little more stable. And by doing that, we do it not only for those regions, or countries we assist, we do it for our own interests. And that's a point that Obama has never understood. He's never made to the American public. And the result is what you've described here in your question.
You know, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe you think something else, but, you know, I believe we're in for at least two more years of this, you know, terrorists running wild, ISIS going crazy, because Obama will not take a stand. And, you know, looking forward and on your experience, when we elect a new president, is this going to, you know, get worse because they're testing the new American president, or are they going to step back a little bit and see the strength of this president and see, you know, what they're up against? What, you know, what do you think will happen with a new American president?
Well, first of all, of course, we will see, because we'll, you know, we still don't know, of course, who's going to occupy the White House in 2 years. I think you're certainly right, Aaron, that for the next 2 years, it's going to be a very bumpy foreign policy ride. We're certainly going to, almost certainly going to have a major fight over immigration now. But in the Middle East and in Ukraine, you know, we are seeing situations that almost certainly will still be around 2 years from now. This president doesn't have the wherewithal or the commitment to bring either of these situations to some kind of, you know, appropriate resolution. And, you know, for that reason, whenever the next whoever is the next occupant of the White House, you know, in 2 years' time, when he or she comes to office, you know, as in cases in the past, the likelihood is they will be tested. Now, it'll be very interesting to see how, you know, what attitude, what positions, what words they say on the campaign trail, because everyone around the world will be listening and watching. But the likelihood is, particularly given, you know, what's probably going to be 8 years of a failed U.S. foreign policy, that, again, whether it's Republican or Democrat, 2 years down the road, that they will have these problems on their plate. And one way or the other, the likelihood is that they will be tested, maybe in ways that we know, maybe in ways we can't even think of. But, you know, this is the accumulated bitter fruit, I would argue, Aaron, for, again, 8 years of a very weak administration.
What's it going to take for the next administration to get this turned around? I mean, you know, you have 8 years of you know, failed policies, especially in foreign policy. And, you know, it's like a ship or a train. You just can't bring it to a stop on a dime, and you have to, you know, turn it slowly to get to where you want to go. So what's the next American president really going to have to do for us to have respect on the international stage and for people to realize that, you know, we are still the most powerful country in the world, and that you can't do this to United States citizens and get away with it?
Well, you know, I mean, that's the blueprint for the next foreign policy. And your question, I would, I guess, offer a few thoughts. Number one, be friends with your friends, you know, whether in the Middle East, Europe, Asia, you know, the Japanese, for example. You know, number two, as I mentioned, we really need to turn around the U.S. defense budget. You know, this yo-yoing of, you know, sharp rises and sharp declines does nothing to help the military, and that does nothing to help the U.S. national interest. Number three, I would love to see a president, again, Democrat or Republican, who really, you know, talks the talk and walks the walk. Is, by that I mean, demonstrates real leadership, you know, both at home and abroad, and send a message both to our friends and our adversaries, you know, that we are back. We are, you know, we will demonstrate that we are not to be trifled with, and we will apply our resources judiciously, but when and where, you know, our interests are threatened. If we don't do that, we will, you know, we'll be back into this kind of morass or quicksand, you know, that has been the hallmark of this administration's dealings with the world.
You know, and I hate to say it, and I hate to put it like this, but in some ways, ISIS is Putin's best friend when it comes to the United States, because, you know, the media always talks about ISIS when there's a beheading, and the light comes off of Russia and Putin and his aggressive, and he I think he's a thug too, his behaviors. What's going on over there? Because, you know, Russia does pose somewhat of a threat to the United States, and especially Vladimir Putin.
Well, first of all, Aaron, you know, I've met Putin, and your assessment of him is one with which I fully agree. Distinctly unpleasant individual in many ways, but again, clever, dangerous. You know, he clearly feels he has the upper hand on this U.S. president. You know, what he did in Ukraine, and where I fully agree with you that he's extraordinarily dangerous, is that he basically overturned Russia's 1994 commitment, legally binding, that they signed with the Ukrainian government and the United States, that said that all three parties to this document would not disrupt or any way compromise the sovereignty of Ukraine, which is exactly what Putin did earlier in the year when he annexed with force Crimea, and now he's up to more mischief in eastern parts of Ukraine. You know, what this says, again, this is a blatant challenge to NATO, blatant challenge to the United States. Now, we don't have any legal obligation in a treaty sense to Ukraine, but I would say, you know, given what Putin's done, the way he's done it, that at the very least, you know, we should have been providing the Ukrainian government the military armaments and support, you know, at least for them to help themselves, and we haven't done that. So, you know, what you have, again, Putin probably laughing his tail off in the Kremlin, feeling that he's captured something that he very much wants. It won him, you know, great popularity in Russia. His approval ratings are through the roof. They're still very, very high. And this has been a win-win for him, but it also sets a really dangerous precedent that both the Americans and the Europeans essentially turned at least politically, a blind eye to what Russia did. Now, I've got to add, in fairness, that the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia by the United States and the Europeans, you know, has hurt the Russian economy. You know, there's no doubt about that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Russia is looking to Asia, particularly the Chinese, to soften some of the blows from the West. And at the end of the day, Russia still has Crimea. And the eastern part of Ukraine, Aaron, actually is the much more industrialized and rich part of the country. So, you know, Putin is, you know, typically running amok, but he's running amok in a very focused and clever way that, again, has gotten the drop on Obama and a very weak foreign policy team.
And really quick before we go, we just have a couple more minutes, but, you know, you mentioned that he has great popularity in Russia. You know, where does that stem from? Is it that you know, the United States, other European countries aren't holding him accountable, so, you know, he has this perceived image as being able to run the world, and it's a sense of Russian pride? Or is it that they truly believe that they think he is doing just an outstanding job, and that everything he's doing is truly to benefit Russia and, you know, not his own egotistical, you know, sense of self-worth?
Well, you know, a great question, Aaron. I think part of the answer, and, you know, others may have different interpretations, but I think there's a couple of factors at play here with Russia. Number one, I think Russia was embarrassed and even humiliated when the Soviet Union broke up in 91. It was followed by, as you know, Boris Yeltsin, who was drunk most of the time. He was an embarrassment as a leader. Putin comes on the scene in 2000, much more disciplined, physically fit, very focused, old KGB, and clearly he has played to the element of Russian national pride, as you mentioned, in trying to look like, you know, he is the defender of Mother Russia. He is restoring Russia to its destiny and its destined greatness, you know, manifest destiny in Russia. And he's doing it, you know, he's a bully in the sense that, you know, he's doing it at expense of the weak, small nations around him. I mean, he's, you know, he's done to the Republic of Georgia much of what he's done in Ukraine. He's obviously threatened Moldova, you know, a tiny nation on the border, you know, the Ukrainian situation. So what we see is Putin trying to flex his muscles. But again, the fact of the matter is Russia has a right to its own security, et cetera, but it does not have a right to its security at the expense of its neighbors. But again, Putin doesn't care very much about that. And he's gauged mostly correctly that the Americans and the Europeans don't care enough to really make it uncomfortable for him to pursue those policies.
Well, you know, hopefully in 2 years we have an American president that will hold terrorists accountable, show that you can't mess with United States citizens or the United States of America, hold leaders like Vladimir Putin accountable, shine the light on truly their wrongdoings and what they're doing. And we're going to need a strong leader to turn all this around. And hopefully, again, the United States can be a leader in the world and a beacon of freedom and democracy and a role model, for this world to become a little bit of a better place. But, you know, Jack Caravelli, thank you so much for your insight. We could probably talk all night about this. And you're welcome back anytime, and I really appreciate your insight.
Aaron, it's a great show. It's a pleasure and privilege to be with you, and best to you, of course, and your listeners.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jack Caravelli joining us live from our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. You know, before we leave, I would like to thank Janine Stang, the National Anthem Girl, also Jack Caravelli for joining us on the show. And I just want you to remember that, you know, just like she was saying earlier in the show, you truly can make a difference in somebody's life. Just walking down the street, smiling at a stranger, you don't know what that person's going through. They could be going through the worst thing imaginable. And just a simple smile would let that person know that maybe you care, that maybe there is hope. Just like she said that person was going to commit suicide, but there was somebody there that smiled at them, and that person is still alive today. Or when you're out and about, thank a military veteran for the freedoms that you have in this country. Make sure you take the time out of your day to thank somebody. Tell them how much they're appreciated, how much you care. And I think the world will be a much, much better place. Thanks for listening in tonight. I truly appreciate it. My thanks again to Janine Stang and Jack Caravelli. Tune in next time, and God bless.